Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest today is Edward Parnell, talking about his book Ghostland, In Search of a Haunted Country. We also hear from Julian Sedgwick and Chie Kutsuwada, talking about their half manga, half prose book Tsunami Girl, and Eleanor Arabella Melville chats about her picture book Umbrella. Edward, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but first of all, welcome to Bookmark.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
And we've talking about manga later. Eleanor is an illustrator, and I was delighted to see there were photos in your book as well, photographs of the places that you go to. Was that important to you that they were in there? It's quite unusual.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit of a nod to W.G. Sebald, whose books famously had these kind of low-tech, grainy photos embedded in there. So I think that was a little part of it. But I like the sort of moody atmosphere that they add, and they do show things that you can't necessarily picture quite so easily. So I thought they were great for atmosphere, really. I definitely wanted them to be grainy and embedded in the text, not separate plates in the middle or something.
And quite a few there of birds, because you are a keen twitcher.
I don't know how much of a twitcher I am these days. I'm kind of I don't go out searching for rare birds quite so much. I used to a lot more. But yeah, definitely watching wildlife and watching birds is a very big thing, and it always has been for me. So yeah.
And pictures in there of your family who play such an important part in the book, your parents and your brother. How did it feel sharing those personal photographs?
I think because once I embarked upon the project, the whole book is kind of a love letter, I suppose, to my family, really. And once I decided that I was going to go back into that territory, it felt like a nice thing to be able to do, to have these pictures of them and to sort of keep their memories going by having them there. So, yeah.
And you talk in the book about the slides that your family used to take of the family holidays, which took me back in time, the little yellow framed slides that you have. You still got those?
I had a box of them that were up in the loft. They're sort of my big reference, really, to lots of these old holidays and these old memories. They were really my one way back into them. These faded, weird sort of 1970s, 1980s slides that I had to scan or, you know, look through was taking me back into barely remembered things from an age ago.
Well, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we'll listen to your first choice of music very shortly. Is music important to you, Edward?
It is, yes. I'm very eclectic in what I like listening to. I'm still quite analogue, and I've got a house full of albums and a loft full of CDs that were taking up too much space. So I like listening to things on physical media still. My CDs are sort of mainly digitised, but I do like actually putting an old album on and seeing it spinning.
And there's a ghosty theme to these. This is There's a Ghost in My House by Ardeen Taylor. Why this one?
It's a real Northern Soul classic, and my older cousin, who's about 15 years older than me, he was hugely into Northern Soul. And I remember as a really small boy, so I'd be 4 or 5, because I was genuinely interested in ghosts at that point. The fact that there was a song called There's a Ghost in My House, and I remember it going to this cousin's 18th birthday party and that song was playing, and I just thought it was great because it mentioned a ghost. But then much later on, I got quite into Northern myself. So yeah, that's why it's there.
There's a ghost in my house. Of your memory, the ghost of the love you took from me.
That was There's a Ghost in My House by Ardeen Taylor, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Edward Parnell. Ed's first novel, The Listeners, was the winner of the Rethink New Novels Prize. His second book, Ghostland, which we'll be discussing today, was shortlisted for the Pen Ackley 2020 Award for Memoir. In it, he goes in search of the sequestered places of the British Isles, the moors, cemeteries, shores and woodlands that have conjured and shaped a spectrum of literature and cinema, from the ghost stories of M.R. James to the children's fantasy novels of Alan Garner to the cult horror film The Wicker Man. And during these explorations, he discovers and comes to terms with the loss and the ghosts in his own past. The Guardian called it a wonderfully evocative book. And Mark Cocker, the naturalist and a very recent guest on this show, said this book is an account of the wraiths and apparitions on the page, but also a tender consideration of how our experience is shaped and enriched by our encounter with life's real ghosts. I enjoyed it very much, Ed, very much indeed. And I was thinking when I was coming to writing that introduction of what genre it fell in, and it seems to me it spans several, because there are points where it's a little bit like literary criticism, other points that are very strongly memoir, and other bits that are almost travel writing.
Yes, it was always, I think, I always wanted it to be a mix, probably because I think I would get bored just writing about one sort of subject. I always knew, for instance, that even though it's not a massive part of the book, that the nature writing elements, for instance, because bird watching was quite a big part of my childhood and growing up and then sort of later adolescence, etc. I knew that I'd want some of those memories to come out in it. And I suppose just because when I was traveling around for the book, I would invariably see different birds and want to comment on them. So I knew that it was a book that, as you say, there's a lot of cultural criticism in there, lots of films, old TV series, books, short stories that I wanted to talk about. But I also wanted to visit the places that might have inspired those particular writers or stories or filmmakers. So there was all of that tied really alongside the kind of heart of the novel that's the, as you say, the memoir part, really.
And when did you know that you were going to write this?
It came around in an unusual way, I think, in that I actually got contacted by an editor at HarperCollins who'd read a rare blog post that I'd written about the place where M.R. James, the great Victorian Edwardian ghost story writer, where he grew up, the little village of Great Livermere in Suffolk. So I visited there trying to get inspiration for a novel, actually. I was sort of thinking of writing another novel, and I thought, well, maybe M.R. James could appear as himself, as a very minor character in it, and wrote this short blog piece with lots of moody photos. And probably a couple of months later, I got this email out of the blue from Tom, who was to become my editor, asking whether I'd ever thought about writing a non-fiction book about authors like James and Algernon Blackwood, Arthur Machen, people like that. And these were all people who I was massively into. And I then went away and thought how I would, were I to do it, because I had kind of reservations, because I hadn't ever thought about writing a non-fiction book. I was trying to write another novel at that point. One of my fears was that I had a bit of imposter syndrome, I think, that, well, I'm not an academic, there's people far better qualified than me to write about these people. And also there's that fear I get a lot, and I think lots of writers do, that someone else will beat you to it. You'll start writing the book and then you'll be 2 months before publication and find out that somebody famous has written a book on the similar subject and yours will sink without trace. But to sort of alleviate that, I thought, well, were I to write it, what can I kind of bring to it that's novel, really? I then thought about my own rather haunted family history and my own kind of relationship with ghosts and the supernatural and all of that literature and film, etc. Then these strange coincidences that lots of the places we'd been on family holidays when I was very small were places that had links to some of these writers like M.R. James and Machen and people. So once I kind of thought that, I then went away and did a proposal for the book, and they really liked the idea of it. They liked the idea that it would be cross-genre and it would have that mix of memoir and travel writing. I think they were a little bit surprised because I'd not talked to Tom about all of the autobiographical family stuff. He knew I'd been really into ghosts and ghost stories and horror films from a young age, but we'd mainly talked about our shared love of quite trashy old 1960s and 70s horror films and things. So I think when actually they saw all this other stuff in the proposal about my family story, that was quite a surprise to them.
How did it feel bringing up all those family issues, all those memories? Because there are points in the book where you do address directly your parents and other members of your family. How was that for you in terms of sharing that?
I don't know how much I was thinking, oh, I'm sharing this. I think that was a kind of slightly surreal moment when I finally saw the book there, that I perhaps had a slight panic. Oh God, I've shared all of this really personal stuff here, and that's quite unlike me. But I think I was so engrossed in the process and so wanted to breathe life into the story of my family, really, that I wasn't worried about sharing it. That was its whole raison d'etre, really. I remember quite early on that slightly hopeless feeling you can get when you're starting on a big new project, when it feels a bit overwhelming and thinking, oh, how am I ever going to write this? Because it's, you know, a very different book to the one I'd written before, which was a novel. And I was talking to another friend of mine who's a writer who said to me, think how lucky you are that you've had this book commissioned, you get to tell this story. And I could see that. And then I viewed it almost as a sacred duty, really. I had this wonderful opportunity to write about my family and write about all this wonderful literature and films and landscape and wildlife and things that I was into. It's a book about things that I was interested in. So, yeah.
And with that literature and film, I mean, as you say yourself, you were watching horror films way earlier than perhaps you should have been.
Yeah.
and reading them as well. So this has been a genre that has always fascinated you, the ghost story, the horror film.
It has, yeah. I mean, I talk in the book about how I was interested in ghosts, and by that I mean real ghosts, if that's the thing. I know when we sort of went on holiday, I'd be there in a castle asking the guide whether there were any ghosts there, and that was when I was 4 or 5 or something, and I had lots of ghostly games and things and these glow-in-the-dark ghosts that were on my bedroom wall. Then I got a little bit older and got into getting my aunt and uncle, because they had a video before we did, getting them to video Universal horror films, Dracula and Frankenstein and things, off late night telly for me. And then in the summer holidays when I'd go around there, I'd watch those. And then I graduated to things like The Wicker Man and American Werewolf in London and stuff. So I think I was watching films before I was reading stuff. And actually my earlier things I was reading about were probably more non-fiction ghost stuff, because there were quite a lot of influential children's books at the time, like the Usborne books, Guide to the Supernatural and things. So I was reading things like that, and then books about horror films. And then I got quite into fantasy literature and Tolkien, and that's where I would have come upon Alan Garner and Susan Cooper, and all of those people are sort of feature as well.
And the ghost story that it seems to me that you really like, it's not the kind of classic blood and gore one. You prefer more of a psychological one, more where you can't quite see what the ghost is or who the ghost is.
Yeah, I like those really classic Victorian Edwardian stories. So probably most of the writers that are in there are from that era. And I think my favourite authors are people like M.R. James and Algernon Blackwood, Walter de la Mare, whose stories I really admire. They're very ambiguous stories, and often you're never quite sure whether there is even a supernatural element in them and what's quite going on. I mean, with M.R. James, they're more formulaic. There's not that many ghosts in them. They're actually, with him, they're more sort of medieval terrors and horrors, things straight out of biblical apocrypha and things and medieval manuscripts. I'm not hugely into kind of blood and guts horror. I will happily watch The Evil Dead or The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, some of the better examples. Certainly in terms of fiction, I like those mysterious, strange old atmospheric stories, yeah.
And in your travels, you do find yourself in some spooky situations, particularly when you get lost in moors and various things like that.
I guess I've always had a tendency, probably through that birdwatching thing. So even as quite a young boy, I was wandering around, because I grew up in Lincolnshire in the Fens, wandering around on my own birdwatching along the local rivers and things. And then that's just been something that I've always subsequently done. I'm quite used to wandering about lonely places in round woods and things on my own. So I wouldn't say I'm very easily spooked, actually. And I don't think I ever really have been. I know as a boy, I was in the church choir, which was this rather nice old 13th century church. That sort of added to my love of the Gothic and things, because you'd be there on a cold winter's evening, and afterwards some of us would go and play in the graveyard and stuff before we got picked up. So I was used to hanging around churches in the dark and stuff as well. So yeah, I don't get easily spooked by things, and I'm not, if there are such things as ghosts, I don't think I've got a very good radar for them. I'm the opposite of those kind of psychic people who you get in Blythe Spirit or something. I would probably, all sorts of ghosts stood behind me kind of waving, and I wouldn't be picking up on them.
Well, you say that you're a non-believer in ghosts. Is that the case? And ghosts and magic as well?
No, I wouldn't say I'm a non-believer. I'm a bit like M.R. James, I think, who famously once said in a quote that I'm prepared to consider evidence and accept it if it satisfies me. I think I'm like that. I'm possibly more believing in, you know, there's lots of people who've claimed to seen and heard things. I have friends who, some of the places I went to would say, oh, I wouldn't have gone there. I wouldn't have been in, you know, I wouldn't have gone to that church, wouldn't have done that. And when I went there, I you know, because I don't pick up on any of this stuff, I have no logic. I don't claim to know what any of these things, if they do exist, are. I have a reasonably open mind. I'm on the side of the skeptic, but I'm not an absolute skeptic and non-believer, no.
Thank you, Ed. Well, let's stay with magic for a while now and speak to Eleanor Aravilla Melville. She's a graduate of the Cambridge School of Art MA in Children's Book Illustration. Her picture book, Umbrella, has been endorsed by Amnesty International and won the Queen's Knickers Award 2020. It was also longlisted for the 2021 UK LA Award and nominated for the Kate Greenaway Medal and a White Raven. It tells the story of a young girl, Clara, who finds a magical umbrella that can make wishes come true. That's the plot. But when I spoke to Eleanor, I asked her what the book was really about.
I took your question to our family dinner, and my 11-year-old said that it was about Sherry. My 16-year-old said it was about compassion. And my husband said that it was about how the good in the world just multiplies itself. For me, it's impossible to say what it's about because there are so many things that I resolved in the process of writing it. But I think that mostly it's a little bit about redemption, about how we can do wrong but still be integrated into our community. It's about community. It's about being kind when you're not expected to. But all of those things, I didn't sort of intend. In a way, they just sort of resolved themselves when I was resolving the story.
This is a picture book. So what age group is this aimed at?
Primary, kids stage one, children. Children can read it on their own, but as any picture book, it's most enjoyed when it's shared with your parents or grandparents or carers.
And in terms of putting it together, what was the process for you? Did the story come first and then the pictures, or did they arrive together or the pictures first?
Well, my process of writing is very mishmashy. So this is the first book that I did after university. And in my degree project, I had made a story that was way too complicated. And I thought, you know, I need to make a story about something that's very ordinary and very simple. So I already had in my head that I wanted to make a story about an umbrella. At the time, it was mostly thinking more of a concept book, perhaps like a board book, like open shot, and things happening. And then at the same time, I was thinking about greed post-2008. And so that was sort of in my mind. So in a way, I thought, I need a villain. So it started with an object and a villain. But at that point, I didn't know what the object was for or why a villain would want it. And then it was a question of a little bit of luck and a little bit of dreaming and a lot of collaboration. I have a cat. He brought a mouse and was playing with it. And you know how cats sometimes put things in the air. So there's this poor, unfortunate mouse that my cat had brought in, gone inside of one of our umbrellas, just by the door. And one day when it was raining and I took the umbrella out, I opened the umbrella and out pops a dead mouse. It was gruesome and terrible, but for the thing that I was conceiving and the thing that I was plotting, I thought, oh my goodness, animals come out of the umbrella. And then I started to think about who would need these animals to come out. And then I sort of dreamt where something opened, thousands of butterflies flew out. All of those things started to be put together. And it started off with, I'm showing you now, the first version of the book.
It's tiny.
Yes, which is a tiny little maid's book. And the umbrella was already in the park. And in the beginning, I thought, okay, this little girl needs the umbrella. Perhaps she needs something. What does she need? As with any form of writing, you just have to put it there and it evolves as you work on it some more to just follow its own logic.
How did you decide on what form the illustrations would take?
Well, I have this aspiration to have something called economy of line, like to make the minimum amount of work. I put just enough to convey the information that I want to say while also allowing space for interpretation. I just wanted to make it vague enough that this park could be anywhere and that these people could be anybody, but at the same time, distinct enough that you could understand what was happening. So I knew that I wanted it to be very sparse in terms of, for instance, the scenery. For me, the park was enough to have a path and a bench and a tree, and that was it. And in terms of the colors are really important in my work. I used to be a painter before I was an illustrator. And so I developed something called a chromatic sequencing. So I wanted to know, once I had developed the whole story, where colors would come in. and what function they would fulfill. Colors are super important in conveying emotion, demonstrating the feelings of the characters. And so in the beginning, everything is very toned down and very blue. And so when you first see Clara, there's only like blue and gray and black and very, very little color. When the umbrella starts to do some magic, a little pink arrives. And as you turn the page, suddenly there's a lot more of that pink. And then it goes back into being very empty of that warmth. I was playing with that the colors would give you that added information about the rhythm of the emotions through the book.
And with children's books, you know that they're going to be read probably by an adult to a child. You're giving information on each page about emotions and about plot. And there's a lot in there, isn't there, that is almost subconscious for a reader.
Yes, the text, you have no choice but to read it in a line. But how you read an image, I can manipulate a little bit of where I put the most details. So that's where your eye goes immediately. But there are things around that you sort of absorb in different rhythms. And if you read it with somebody else, they will notice other things before you do. So that's where I needed to have enough information to say, okay, this is an apple tree, but also it could be any apple tree, not just one particular one. With images and how you read them, there is a lot of research that even in a book that has such little amount of elements as this one, you would think that a bench is just a bench. But if you research benches, you realize that it's very specific of culture, the shape of the benches, what materials they have. And so I came up with a bench that was a little bit like a bench that you could find in England, but a bench that you could find somewhere else. But when it came, for example, to Mr. Robert's wheelchair, because he was going to be dancing on the wheelchair later on, I needed to find out what sort of injury he would have had and what sort of wheelchair he could have used. And then suddenly, like, this world of other things open to me as a writer to just discover all these differences. You know, a wheelchair is not just a wheelchair. There's multiple kinds of them. And I hope that those details, I hope that they help to enrich reading the images experience.
And the book is endorsed by Amnesty International. How important was that to you?
That came even before it was published. And what they said was that Amnesty International UK endorses this book because it celebrates our rights to express ourselves and to choose our own friends. What a lovely thing to hear about your work. I mean, I was really blown away and did not expect it at all. I was very, very, very happy with this.
And you're a graduate of the amazing MA in Children's Book Illustration at Anglia Ruskin University. So many outstanding graduates of that course. Could you have done this book, Umbrella, without going on that MA?
I don't know. I would have been someone else. If I hadn't been on the course, I would have not met the people that I met. I would have not learn all the things that I learned during the course. The great thing about the course, I mean, besides obviously the outstanding teachers and the facilities, is your peers. I think that that's like the most important aspect of the master's degree, is your colleagues and how these colleagues have become lifelong friends, people that I can trust to give my little very fragile concepts to them and say, well, what do you think of this? So I don't think that I would have written this book now. Even, for instance, how I got to meet my publisher came through an activity that came as a consequence of having been on the course. So in a way, when you go to a course, every person that you meet opens like a huge amount of chains of opportunities. You know, I don't think that I could have written this book if I hadn't been on the course, no.
And Umbrella by Eleanor Arevalo Melville is published by Scallywag Press. Our featured guest on Bookmark today is Edward Parnell, talking about his book, Ghostland. Ed, East Anglia features quite a lot in your book, not just because you grew up there, but because, there's M.R. James, obviously associated with Cambridge. You talk about Greenough Manor, Hemingford Grey, the landscape of the Fens. There's a lot going on in this part of the world.
There is, yes. And I wonder sometimes whether those big skies are part of that. I certainly think for people who my homeland of the Fens, people often talk about, oh yeah, that's a very spooky landscape, isn't it? I can see how it is to people who aren't familiar with it, because it's such an unnatural landscape. Well, it's a completely man-made landscape, and it's quite disorientating because of its lack of landmarks and topography and things. But I suppose to me it's not disquieting or spooky in that I grew up there, so it's a very familiar landscape. But I certainly think there's lots of stories set there, and that's a landscape that people most talk to me about that they find spooky. So there's something interesting about that, I think. And the same could be said, I suppose, about the Norfolk and Suffolk coast as well, with all those salt marshes and vast shingle beaches, and again those big expanses of sky and grey ominous water. There's something, I think, about the East Anglian landscape and all of that pressing history, all of those old churches and old flint walls. It still looks exactly like something out of an M.R. James story in many places. So that always helps as well, I think.
And M.R. James, perhaps the most famous ghost story writer of Cambridge, but there are quite a few others either lived here or were from here.
There were various other ones who sort of followed in James's footsteps, really, and took inspiration from him. But then even more recent novels, there's a wonderful novel by Penelope Fitzgerald called The Gate of Angels, which is set in a fictionalised all-male Cambridge College, but it has a disguised version of M.R. James appears in it, and there's a wonderful Jamesian ghost story that's in there. So there's lots of stuff in there, and I think that Fenland landscape certainly helps, and, well, with Cambridge itself, all of the pressing history is a good factor for that as well, I think.
And reading as you travel around and you talk about ghost stories, it makes you aware, if you weren't already, of the importance of setting in a ghost story.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the thing that most appeals to me. Place was a massively important part of my novel, The Listeners, set in the start of the Second World War in deepest, darkest Norfolk, in this strange, cut-off, wooded landscape that's not really changed very much for a few hundred years. In my own writing, that was something that I always liked to concentrate on. So I think I see that in other writers' work, and I'm instantly drawn to it. I mean, somebody like Alan Garner, those children's books, the first ones that are set on Alderley Edge in Cheshire, which I go and visit in the book, and then his wonderful book, The Owl Service, that's set in Snowdonia. The sense of place in those books is just fantastic, and that's one of the huge draws of them, I think.
So sense of place with a history and perhaps an unease about them, important in a ghost story. What else makes a good ghost story?
It's a very hard thing to analyse, I think. And I love reading short stories, and short stories also beyond being weird or spooky stories as well. I'm a big fan of Alice Munro or Tobias Wolff or other people writing more realist short stories. But it's interesting as a writer, because when I read them, I find it very hard to... I'll read a particular story and think how good it is, but then struggle to decode what makes it so good. I think there's a real magic in a short story, actually, that's harder to work out what the writer's doing than in a novel, where you've got longer to sort of look at the structure and work out what that particular magic is. But in a short story, things come together for quite odd reasons. I mean, one of my a more recent writer that I talk about is Robert Aikman, another weird ghost story writer from the 50s through to about the 70s. And his stories, a bit like those of Walter de la Mare, who I mentioned earlier, they're quite ambiguous in places and go off on very strange tangents and difficult to work out what he's doing, but they're all the better for that, I think. And those are the stories I like, well, actually the ones that are less obvious. I mean, James's stories are just so brilliantly put together, and his style works so well, but they're more formulaic, I think, but that doesn't matter. Yeah, with some of those other writers, it's the odd things that they do and the unexpected, I think, that really gets you.
And I wonder if there's something about a ghost story that stops it from dating maybe as easily as another story, because it's tapping into elemental fears, superstitions, because lots of the ghost stories that you like are quite old in that sense.
Yeah, and they're dealing with the biggest topic, really, of life and death. So that's a big part of it. Although I think M.R. James, for instance, liked to set his stories in he had a lovely phrase, a haze of distance is desirable, referring to about 30 years or so. So he always liked to set his stories, bearing in mind he might have been writing a story in 1901, something like that, but it would be set in middle Victorian period or possibly a bit earlier, but generally in a critique of ghost stories, he points out that a story wouldn't work as well if it's set in medieval times, because the reader can't really picture that world as easily. But if you set something that's 20 or 30 years ago, then it's sort of hazy and memories coming into it as well. And that was a big part of my book, because a lot of my book, the memoir elements, are looking back actually about 30 years. So that haze of distance is also something that I'm utilising as well.
Well, let's see your second choice of music now, which is Corn Rigs by Magnet from the film Wicker Man. We could spend a whole hour talking about the film Wicker Man and still not say enough. Why this one? I'm tempted to say, just tell me all you can about the Wicker Man.
The Wicker Man is one of those films I watched again at far too young an age, and it's one of my favourite films. I'd love to be able to watch it again, not knowing what was going to happen, or even to be able to remember when I first watched it, how I react to the shocks and surprises that come in it. But it's just a wonderful film. I loved going back to Ghostland, going to the places where it was filmed, and even though it's set on Summer Isle, it's not actually filmed on an island. It was filmed on the Dumfries and Galloway coast, so very lonely bit of West Scotland, but actually all of the locations are on the mainland. I love the music in it. I mean, I would say it's virtually a musical, and the music's used so well. There's these sort of folky songs in it, including this one, which is a traditional Scottish song that was famously reworked by Robert Burns, and actually the Wicker Man's film just down the coast from where he lived. I just love going up there, and I love the film and I love the music from it.
It was upon a Lammas night when corn rigs are bonny.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
In 1960s Cambridge, you might have shopped at Joshua Taylor, gone roller skating at the Corn Exchange, and seen the Beatles perform live at the Regal Cinema. On Sunday mornings, John Gannon takes you back in time with hits and memories from the swinging decade. John Gannon's 60s scene, Sundays at 8 a.m. on the station that's live and local, Cambridge 105 Radio.
Looking to buy a new home this summer, but it feels out of reach? Think getting on the property ladder just isn't an option for you? Think again. New homes in Haverhill and Cottenham are available now with shared ownership, with your mortgage deposit as low as from £4,000. The final 2 and 3 bedroom homes at Bower Place and Boyton Place also have exclusive incentive packages available worth over £2,500. With £1,000 shopping vouchers, £500 towards your solicitor's fees, and 3 months rent free, book your viewing today to find out what's on offer. Reserve from just £99 and find your new home this summer. Think shared ownership. Think Complete Moves. Visit complete-moves.co.uk or call 020 3640 7111 today. Terms and conditions apply.
Need dropping off at work? Missed the bus and must make that urgent appointment? Need picking up after a night out with your mates? Panther Taxis is your Cambridge-based taxi firm with over 700 drivers, offering great rates and local knowledge, ensuring you make it quickly and safely to your destination. We don't inflate our prices at peak times, and all our drivers accept payments by cash or card. Book your taxi the easy way. Download our free Panther Taxis app through your app store and start booking your taxis on the go. Call Cambridge 715 715 or see panthertaxis.co.uk. Panther Taxis, your local, quick, reliable and friendly taxi company in the city.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our featured guest on Bookmark today is Edward Parnell, talking about his book, Ghostland. Ed, folk stories often used in ghost stories. I mean, we heard the music from The Wicker Man and it was a folk song. And folk stories often are the basis for ghost stories or ghost films.
Yes, there's lots of local legends that find their way into such things. And lots of the books I talk about in Ghostland have a local folklore sitting somewhere at the heart of it. I love all of that stuff as well. I know a bit after my ghosty phase when I was at university, I had a big spell when I got really into visiting ancient monuments and old standing stones and stone circles. I had a particular book by Janet and Colin Board called Mysterious Britain that was a sort of gazetteer of such sites, and used to sort of go around looking at those as well. So I'd like that side of folklore as well. So there's quite a lot of that stuff that seeps into the book as well.
And what also interested me in the book was that the authors you named, many of whom I didn't know had written ghost stories, it's often their lesser known stories that are the ghost stories. For John Buchan, for example, I had no idea that he had also written ghost stories.
Yeah, and lots of writers back then did try their hands at ghost stories. I mean, I suspect that that was partly because the short story as a form was something where writers could earn money from, which you can't really today, I don't think. A lot of writers who are better known for writing more realist fiction turn their hands to it. I mean, somebody like Edith Wharton, for instance, in America, is a brilliant writer of ghost stories. So, yeah, lots of people who you wouldn't necessarily know. I mean, Buchan, as I say, wrote some wonderful, largely Scottish set ones. But there's a whole host of people out there who also had an attempt at it.
And quite a few were sons or daughters of clergymen. There's often quite a link with the church.
Yeah, so James was the son of a Suffolk vicar. E.F. Benson, an acquaintance of James, was one of the famous Benson brothers. Actually, two of his brothers also wrote a few supernatural stories as well. They were the son of the Bishop of Cornwall, who was later the Archbishop of Canterbury. So you can't get any more religious than that. William Hope Hodgson, another son of a vicar. Being religious, I suppose, means that you're open to the ideas of the supernatural. In that's a sort of basic tenet I'd have thought of believing in a deity. So that, and of course, you know, lots of Christianity, certainly when you go back a bit, much more of it was to do with heaven and hell and that Jamesian kind of world of demons and devils and things. So, yeah, I can see how it would have opened their minds to that. And also just those Gothic settings of growing up, I suppose, in where your playground would have been the graveyard, or where you'd have been wandering around the local old church. That sort of thing probably helped, as it did with me, I'm sure.
And we're going to hear from Julian Sedgwick and Chie Kutsuwada in just a moment about their book Tsunamigirl, which is set in Japan. In terms of international traditions, if you like, about ghost stories and ghost storytelling, is that interesting to you? Is that something you'd like to explore?
It's certainly interesting to me. Consciously with Ghostland, I wanted it to be about the British Isles. I took a conscious decision not to go further afield. I mean, for one thing, it would have been the most enormous book, I think, if I had have done. But, you know, who knows? Maybe somewhere down the line, there might be scope for something else if someone wanted to commission it.
Thank you. I will come back to you in just a moment now, but let's hear from Julian and Chie. Julian Sedgwick is the author of 6 books for children and the co-author with his brother Marcus of the graphic novel Dark Satanic Mills. The first book in his Mysterium trilogy, The Black Dragon, won the Rotherham Children's Book Award, and his most recent book, Voyages in the Underworld of Orpheus Black, was shortlisted for the Carnegie Medal 2020. Chie Kutsuwada is a Japanese manga artist. She's the creator of King of a Miniature Garden and Moonlight. Tsunamigirl, a collaboration between Julian and Chie, was published this month. Part manga, part prose. They told me what the novel is about.
It's about a girl who doesn't know quite where she fits in life, and she feels she fits a long way from her home. She grows up in Cambridge and she believes she belongs more in Japan. She's quarter Japanese and three quarters English. She goes to visit her ex-manga artist grandfather in Japan, and she gets caught up in the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. And it's really a story about how we deal with huge unforeseen crises in life. I was tasked with finding an illustrator. The publisher and I really wanted it to be a Japanese artist, someone who'd bring a real authentic Japanese manga quality. And through a mutual friend, actually in Cambridge, another cartoonist called Emma Viacelli, she said, try Chie, she's great. And I got in touch with Chie, and maybe Chie can take it up from there.
At first, I was a bit worried about everything, but I had a really nice conversation with him, and then I decided, okay, I should take it.
I wrote the whole book with the manga written in a kind of script format, but then I really wanted to leave it up to Chie to change things and bring her creative vision to it. Because although I draw a bit, I can't do sequential storytelling. So I just hoped that I'd written a script that was illustratable.
He gave me a really well-written manga script. I found it comfortable with working with. Manga tended to have less panels in a page than Western-style comic, and he understood that, which made my life very, very easy, actually. Another thing is, even though he gave me a detailed script, he allowed me to explore, you know, change the pace and everything. So it was a lovely script to work with, actually.
I've just come off doing another illustrated book, and I've just become really interested in the idea that sometimes images can carry a story more strongly than prose, or at least as strongly. And because this had a theme of a manga artist character, it just seemed like an interesting challenge. And it's one of two threads of stories. So one thread is told in prose. The tricky part was trying to work out which part was going to be in manga and if it would work. But as soon as I saw Gio's first drawings, I thought this is going to be all right.
I've never worked with this way. You know, I always do whole book, illustration, manga style. But I thought it might boost each other's points. It's really worked well. It's actually a good thing because it's a pick up the best thing about both the written language and also drawing. So it's the two best things together. So why not?
The prose is really giving a linear story of something that happens to our lead character, Yuki. And then the manga is telling something that is happening more or at least half in imagination. I really wanted this to be a book about how we use creative imagination when we face monumental crises or problems in life. And if it's a device that can help lift you. I have a lot of friends in Japan and friends in Fukushima City, not far from the radiation. And as soon as it happened, I just thought this is a colossal, almost unimaginable event. You know, you only have to look back at a few bits of video from it. It's something almost beyond imagination. And so I wanted to write it incredibly respectfully, obviously, but also about how we face things that are almost too big to process.
None of my family or close friends didn't affect by that. But I was here in the UK and then hadn't had news and then watched news footage. And then I was actually really traumatized. So I stopped watching and reading about it. And actually, when Julian talked to me, I thought it was time for me to look what exactly happened and look why I'm deeply traumatized, even though I was not directly affected by anything. I cannot compare with the feeling with the people who really affected by the earthquake, but for me, working with Julian is a kind of therapy to face the fact something really disastrous happened to my country.
I went twice to the Fukushima recovery towns to talk to people about how they coped and what they'd seen and what did the waves sound like? What did the tsunami sound like for you? Because everybody's experience was almost unique. It was like, 100,000 different disasters. We got to go on a very early version of a tour into the radiation exclusion zone because so much research these days you can do on YouTube, but some things you can't feel. And I knew I had to go and stand in that space and try and see what it felt like. But it was a totally surreal experience and very much like stepping onto the set of a sci-fi movie and into these abandoned streets with wild animals running around and the Geiger counter ticking away in your hand. Tried to gather as many photographs and things because I knew the illustrator, when we found the right illustrator, was going to need a lot of visual prompts. What a lot of people feel in Northeast Japan is they have been forgotten. So everyone said to me, yeah, please write this and tell the story in a new way. Well, as soon as I can, I will take physical copies of the book back and show them.
At first, I thought it might be really hard for me to look through all the research and everything. And if I have to do my own research a lot, it might actually traumatize me again. But the thing is, when Julian told me he visited there again and again, and he made a lot of friends there, I feel I can trust him. Also, he's got a lot of informative photographs, emotional photographs. So I can start with seeing things and researching things through his research first. Then I can slowly approach to my own research. So I gain some courage to do my own research I try to recreate like atmosphere, or that I've never ever experienced that disaster physically, but it's through my research and through Julian research and also through my imagination, I just imagine how it might sound of tsunami, like wave sounds, but I think inside of you, it might be total silence. That sound I can recreate on my drawing. I try to focus on what you hear, how you feel inside.
And I think you got it really well, because a lot of it felt to me like what I felt when I was out there in the radiation zone and so forth. I think there is a resonance in that, particularly the radiation element, that you can't see it. You're not too sure initially, you know, what's going on. There's a risk all the time. But I think what really comes out of those communities is the togetherness. Everyone kept saying to me, we're not trying to rebuild our old life, rebuild our old towns. We're trying to make a new community. And I think that's going to be really important about aiming for a new normal as we sort of learn to live with this.
And Tsunami Girl by Julian Sedgwick and Chie Katsuwudu is published by Guppy Books. We've been talking on Bookmark today to Edward Parnell about his book Ghostland, which is published by William Collins. Edward, what's next for you? You've had a novel, you've had a memoir. Are you going back to novel writing or staying with nonfiction?
I'm at a little bit of a turning point at the minute, trying to work out what to do next. And that conversation is one that fills my head most of the day. I think from a practical perspective, I'd like to write another non-fiction book in a similar mould, but obviously at the minute it's quite hard to go and do your research and do any travel, or it's impossible to do that. So that's at least been my excuse for the past year why I haven't really got on with anything. With that in mind, I do keep thinking I've got less excuses to not have a go at writing another novel, but I don't think I'm ever going to be particularly prolific. I'm quite good at procrastinating, but yeah, I do feel the urge to get writing again. So I'm hoping that something will start happening soon, yeah.
And so many ghost stories mentioned in your book, but if I had to pin you down and say, what is your favourite ghost story of all time to recommend to our listeners, what would you say?
God, that's really difficult, because I think it changes a little bit with the weather. But M.R. James's stories are consistently good, and there was about 30 stories that he wrote and published. But if I had to come down on one, I'd possibly plump for The Willows by Algernon Blackwood, which is a canoe trip gone a little awry along the Danube at the turn of the century. So that might be the one that I would opt for. Again, it's more of a cosmic horror, weird fiction slant to it, but yeah, that's very, very good.
Thank you. I can see what torture that was for you to have to name one of all. And a question we ask all our listeners on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading a novel that's shortly coming out, the new novel from John McGregor, who wrote the wonderful Reservoir 13, which was one of my favourite books of the last few years. His new novel is quite different. It's set in the Antarctic, the British bases in the Antarctic. I won't say much more about it, as I'm only a little way into it, but it's called Lean, Fall, Stand, and I'm very much enjoying it.
Thank you, Ed. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music, but a heads up that our next show featured guest is Susanna Gregory, talking about her Matthew Bartholomew crime novels, which are set in 14th century Cambridge. We'll hear from Keith Miles and Jackie Lees about the impact of London on the songwriting of Bob Dylan. And Patricia Farah will talk to us about Life After Gravity, her biography of Isaac Newton's time in London. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music today, Ed, which is Thunder Road by Bruce Springsteen. Why this one?
My brother, who 6 years older than me, was a big Springsteen fan. So when Born in the USA came out in 1984, that was all that was played in our house in my memory for a long time. And I used to like it, but I would tease him about it. But gradually, I think it worked its magic on me. And then I also became a huge Springsteen fan. My favourite Springsteen period are definitely those early albums. So Born to Run, which was his third album. This is the first track on it. And it was just a song that appealed to my teenage dreams of escape and you know, maybe getting out of the fens and doing something else. Yeah, it's just this huge, wonderful romantic vision. I loved Americana as a teenager as well, so that's probably why it's there. It makes me think of my brother as well, so that's always a nice thing, I think.
The screen door slams, Mary's dress waves like a vision. She dances across the porch as the radio plays.